Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. NATO's General Secretary Jens Stoltenberg has acknowledged that Vladimir Putin's decision to enter Ukraine last year was to prevent NATO from expanding into the country. The claim it was an unprovoked invasion is propaganda. The West Ukraine narrative is unraveling. Crosstalking Western narratives, I'm joined by my guest, Aaron Good in Philadelphia. He's a political scientist, historian, as well as author of An American Exception, Empire in the Deep State. In Washington, we have Matthew Crosston. He is professor of national security and director of academic transformations at Bowie State University. And in Montreal, we cross to Eve Engler. He is a Canadian Foreign Policy Institute fellow, journalist, and author. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Aaron, let me go to you first. I mean, Stoltenberg, he's not the brightest guy. That's probably why he has the job, because he usually just repeats talking points written in Washington. But he did kind of slip up by saying that the reason why Russia entered Ukraine last year is to prevent NATO expansion. Well, we were told it was an unprovoked attack. That's what they keep saying over and over again. But, you know, Stoltenberg has a habit of doing this. He said, you know, from 2014 to 2022, they were arming Ukraine to the teeth. I mean, they can't keep their narrative straight. And I want to talk about later how the world doesn't believe it. Your thoughts, Aaron?
Well, it's pretty clear that NATO expansion has been well underway since the end of the Cold War, and that the U.S. has never been really candid about its aims and why it was doing what it was doing. But I think that this, with Ukraine, they really crossed the Rubicon in a sense, because they knew precisely, as we know from the WikiLeaks cables with the CIA, current CIA director, that he knew, you know, to more than 10 years ago that NATO was NATO expansion into Ukraine was the reddest of red lines for Russia. And that was precisely why they staged the Maidan coup in the first place, to put in a U.S. friendly government in Kiev. It's not that they were pursuing some diplomacy and then accidentally did something which damaged Russia's security. They intentionally set about inflicting as much harm to Russian security as they could, to threaten Russian security, and their presence in Ukraine, or potential presence in Ukraine, is deemed an existential threat by Russia, and the U.S. knew that, and that was precisely why they did what they did. So this is something that more and more people are coming to understand. In the past, it was only kind of Cold War foreign policy wonks that understood it, and most of them were dissembling about it if they're employed by academia or in think tanks. So the result has been a slow realization that apparently has now finally reached the head of NATO, that what this war was really about.
Yeah, Matthew, it's really quite interesting, because we got so many off-the-cuff comments, like Lloyd Austin, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, saying he wanted to significantly weaken Russia, okay? And it's comments like that that, you know, and they, of course, people around them correct them, but this is a very, very much provoked war. It was very intentional, as Aaron has pointed out, and this is the path that they were going down. They thought, they truly believed that the sanctions would work, that would cripple Russia's economy. Well, Russia's economy is due to grow 2% this current year, and it only contracted 2.1% last year. So they've grossly miscalculated over and over again, and NATO itself is a military alliance. No, that's the United States, okay? We've seen all through this conflict here that NATO, I wouldn't call it a paper tiger, but it's really not, it's more of a supper club, a political club, than a military alliance. Matthew.
I like the fact that you use even the term miscalculation, because I like what Aaron had mentioned. When do you cross the Rubicon? You cross the Rubicon when you're not worried that anything is on the other side of it to bother you. And that was sort of, there was sort of an implicit arrogance or overconfidence on the part of NATO that it could do in Ukraine what it's done with all of the other additions over the last 10 years in terms of its membership, and there wouldn't be consequences, even despite the very explicit and transparent expressions from the Kremlin saying there will be consequences if you do this. This is different from all the others. NATO just simply didn't believe it. Or what you're mentioning, the miscalculation, is it really so much about provocation as much about we miscalculate and we misinterpreted we meaning NATO, the United States, that Russia has the capability of doing anything. And even if it does, we're able to meet strength with strength without injuring ourselves or damaging ourselves in any way.
Yeah, even Montreal, it's very interesting, is because on this program, unfortunately, you can't watch it on YouTube anymore. But when it was on YouTube, I was telling the world months before the conflict, it's going to happen. It's going to happen on December 17th, before the conflict. The Russians sent out to NATO, to Washington, these are the terms and conditions of negotiating, avoiding a conflict. And they totally blew it off. And Stoltenberg again mentioned, yes, we got this here, but we didn't take it seriously. Those are my words, okay? But he didn't take it seriously, and this is the result here. I mean, this was so transparently obvious that this was going to happen. I was screaming at the top of my lungs, this is going to happen. And nobody in the West believed it. They thought it was this all hyperbole. Eve.
Well, I think in that speech that he made, where he made that admission, which is, of course, a very important admission, and clear this was a provoked war. The other side to what he said was he was boasting about Sweden and Finland joining. So I think from a U.S. perspective, maybe let's call it Anglosphere perspective, this isn't a bad thing, right? You have Finland, you have expansion of NATO, you have Germany specifically, but Western Europe further subordinated to U.S. Geopolitical interests. You know, lessening their purchasing of Russian natural gas and oil and whatnot, and so from a U.S. perspective, the fact that Ukraine is destroyed, the fact that hundreds of thousands are killed or injured, that's fine. That's worth it from a geopolitical perspective. So I think that yes, I agree with you. This was clearly provoked. The counteroffensive is going to fail. There is a bit of a problem for NATO with regards to what they're able to do in Ukraine, because I think it's still possible that Russia at least gets Odessa and expands further. But from a macro perspective, I don't think that this was a bad thing from U.S. geopolitical interest. Obviously, very good for all the arms companies. So it's a little bit of, I think, for Ukraine, it's a disaster, it's catastrophe. And from any sort of humanistic perspective, that's the case. But from a really kind of hardline kind of geopolitical calculation, this is probably all still kind of basically worth it from U.S. Perspective.
I absolutely agree with you. I think that it's a very sober way of looking at. Aaron, speaking of the costs and the benefits here, to date, the Biden administration has slated over $100 billion to Ukraine. What is the return on investment there?
I mean, it's not the return on the investment is a whole lot of Ukrainians who are no longer, among the living, best I can tell. It's hard to know what the point. It seems that Biden may be, and the U.S. may be, trying to avert disaster before the election. And then who knows? I mean, it seems like reality is starting to sink in. You see more reporting in different places in the West that they're just acknowledging the reality that the counteroffensive has failed spectacularly, except in terms of, creating more Ukrainian casualties. So this is, it's been a, that part is a waste. And I disagree with Eve, because I think that this has, it's on the surface, it's good for arms companies and so on, and probably helps with, sell U.S. natural gas and such. But I think that the U.S. is in the point where it can waste $100 billion on war and add to the deficit that way because of its control over the dollar. And I believe that this Ukraine war and the Russian evasion of the sanctions regime and the creation of new institutions to handle international payments, that all these things are going to collude to hasten the demise of the dollar, which is really what the U.S. empire has been based on since the post-Bretton Woods regime really got consolidated a couple years into Reagan's administration. And the U.S. since then has just been this juggernaut, thanks to the power of the dollar and its ability to run endless military.
Well, I think both of you can be right at the same time, because I agree with you as well here. Matthew, you're nodding your head. Jump in.
It's just maybe this is too cynical, but I've said this in the past as well, Peter, is that the ultimate investment in the long run for American perception has always been, wait, you're going to tell us we get to do a proxy war where we get to kill lots of Russians, but we're not going to risk any American lives whatsoever in the conflict. And it will keep going and grinding forward, and we'll be able to pursue through the media public perception that the Russian military is inept, the leadership is incompetent, the small little underdog Ukraine is able to hold it off. See, we've weakened them in terms of geopolitical strength. It's all perceptional and it's somewhat propagandistic, but that's still a return on investment that the United States still sort of stuck in that Cold War mentality finds there are.
Yeah, but Matthew, I think that approach has a shelf life, okay, because of what Eve and Aaron just had to say. Eve in Montreal, let me go to you right before we're going to a short break. You want to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting point about, I agree with there is a potential long term. I think clearly there's a lot of countries that are very concerned by the way in which the Russian National Bank assets were frozen and that question of how they're sort of concerned about the long term reliability of their assets in the West and their use of the U.S. dollar. So that history might point to this being leading to the weakening and breakdown of the dollar hegemony. And so that then history will look back on this as actually very damaging to U.S. Geopolitical interests.
Yeah, well, it's not as if the last 40 years has a road record of success, so I'm not counting on that. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Western narratives. Stay with RT.
Take a fresh look around at life. Kaleidoscopic, isn't it? A shattered reality distorted by power. Tired vision with no real opinions. Pictures designed to simplify or confuse. Who really wants a better world? And is it just for the chosen few? Fractured images presented as fact.
Can you see through their illusions? Going underground can.
Hi, I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm here to plead with you, whatever you do, do not watch my new show. Seriously, why watch something that's so different? Why listen to opinions that you won't get anywhere else? Look, if it pleases you to have the State Department, the CIA, weapons makers, multi-billion dollar corporations choose your facts for you, go ahead. Why change? And whatever you do, don't watch my show. Stay mainstream, because I'm probably going to make you uncomfortable. My show is called Direct Impact. But again, you probably don't want to watch it, because it might just change the way you think.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle Tremendi. We're discussing Western narratives. Okay, let's go back to Aaron in Philadelphia. We recently had the BRICS summit and the G20, and, well, it didn't go so well for the West. They couldn't get their narrative over the top. As a matter of fact, it's really quite remarkable that the G20 ended the way it did. It made a reference to Ukraine, but just the conflict and nothing more. And that was something that we know that the West is trying to globalize, internationalize the Ukraine issue, and it's not getting traction. As a matter of fact, it's been going in reverse here. This is a narrative that, you know, is something that we've talked about in the first part of the program that isn't sustainable. People just simply don't believe what the West is saying. Aaron.
Right. I mean, I think that the U.S. has been the global empire since the end of World War II, and in Europe, it still enjoys some support. But even in Europe, there are signs that the U.S. hegemony may be on the wane there. I think majorities in Germany, for example, believe that the U.S. and NATO are more responsible for the Ukraine war than Russia or Putin. So, and around the world, I mean, West Africa, what's happening in West Africa is related to what's happening in Ukraine in a sense, because the U.S. wanted to use the Ukraine war as a way to create a new Iron Curtain and stop Russia from trading with Western Europe and keep Western Europe aligned with the U.S. But as we see in West Africa, where the French dominate, their hold, their neo-colonial hold, which has been assisted by the U.S. I mean, it's likely, according to Max Blumenthal's dad, Sid Blumenthal, those emails to Hillary, the French were very fearful that Libya was going to basically weaken the French currency in West Africa. And that was one of the reasons they were behind getting rid of Gaddafi, because he wanted a unified Africa. But now even those countries are rebelling against this system. And if they're able to kick France out of West Africa, which they've really been plundering for quite a long time, more than a century, then where does France have to turn but to the east? I mean, this is where the U.S. position as the global hegemon is weakening. And even in Europe, there's a secret suppressed history of things the U.S. and Gladio have done when, if leaders didn't do what the U.S. wanted them to do, even if they were in Western countries, I mean, the U.S. ousted the Australian prime minister in the 1970s. That's not Europe, obviously, but also Aldo Moro, the assassination in like 1972 or 73, and Olaf Palme in, I think, 86, Alfred Herrhausen in the late 80s at the end of the Cold War. I mean, there's just this whole history of bad things that the U.S. has done when it took over management of Western imperialism.
Well, Aaron,
it's all bills are coming due.
His bills are coming due. And Aaron, let me go to Matthew now. What about Nord Stream? I mean, these people that glorify climate change and all this, and you have an administration in the United States, by all accounts, come on, created the worst geological incident in world history, okay? I mean, this is what you do to your friends. What do they do to their enemies? Again, Matthew, this global shift in narratives, I think, is very, very interesting. And we saw the United States outrage about the coup in Niger, but they weren't outraged in 2014 in Ukraine. The world picks up on these things, Matthew.
Well, I think your point also, Nord Stream, I always have thought is underemphasized as an incredibly important on the narrative perspective, simply because that was the one, to me, the one incident that showed significant actors in Western Europe that, wait a minute, the United States always tells us that when it pursues its interests, those American interests also always perfectly align with the global good. And they always try to sell that narrative. But Nord Stream and the ridiculousness, sort of pendulum swinging back and forth explanation of who did it, who possibly could do it, when everyone knew who really did it was the United States, that showed at least certain partners in Europe, partners in quotation marks, that maybe the United States will always just pursue its interests. And if it isn't aligned with the global good, that's not going to matter. Because this Nord Stream incident hurts us in Western Europe.
Well, Matthew, I've talked to a number of Germans ever since then, and I've asked, you know, what do people think about this? And he told me, he said, everybody in Germany knows who did it. You just can't talk about it, okay? That's another thing that's changing in the West. You're not allowed to talk about certain things, questioning elections and things like that. Anyway, Eve, let me go back to you in Montreal. It was interesting. Anthony Blinken said a couple days ago, the old world order is over. But it is over. I think we will all agree with that. But not in the way he thinks. He thinks that, you know, American hegemony has a bright, radiant future. I mean, these people are completely out of touch. Eve.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the China's rise is China has now become the biggest economy in the world. And despite all of the rhetoric about, you know, downturn and short term, China's going to be the dominant economic power and is already the dominant trading nation with something like 100 countries. So that's a problem for the U.S. and we're seeing that their efforts to try to weaken China's economy are not successful. We just saw Huawei coming out with a fancy new phone, which was supposed to not be possible with U.S. Sanctions. But I do also think that to push back a bit against that a little bit, I do think the U.S. has had some degree of success on the military front in subordinating, you know, Philippines. The fact that the Philippines is giving the Americans all these bases, the fact that Australia has just completely gone along, the fact that Japan, you know, is increasing its military spending to target China, they seem to have had some success with bringing Japan and South Korea together. So they are, I think, having some success on the geopolitical, on the military level, on the economic level. It seems to me if things are going, worse and worse for the U.S. And like as you pointed out, obviously the sanctions on Russia, all that stuff has just, you know, it's basically not worked as was planned.
But Eve, let me ask you a question here. But you're talking about a new Cold War when we have new divisions here. Okay, it's going to be Russia, China, and countries around it, and then you have an American-led bloc. I mean, that seems by design. Is that a good idea in your mind? I mean, this could all be avoidable if there was that intent. Go ahead.
This is absolute madness. I think this is total madness. I think from humanity's perspective, I'm somebody who thinks that the top concern should be dealing with the ecological collapse that we're seeing all over. I think we have huge problems of inequity, both in North America and around the world. We have problems of people still dying from diseases that we should have been wiped out a long time ago. I mean,
Russia is the problem. China is the problem. See, this is that narrative, you know. We can't deal with the environment right now. We can't deal with inequality right now. We have to deal with the Russians and the Chinese and authoritarian regimes. That's exactly what Blinken said a day ago. Go ahead, Eve.
And you just look around. I mean, here in Montreal, there's just reports about homelessness, right? All across North America, homelessness is up huge amounts since the pandemic. These are real problems right here. But we hear all of this discussion about security. Well, the forests are burning all around me in Montreal all the summer. Forests are burning. Well, that's a real security threat. There's huge health consequences from all the pollutants. Obviously, the danger of the fires. But we're told security, and what they really mean is joining the U.S. empire to send Canadian naval vessels halfway across the world to provoke China in the Taiwan Strait or the South China Sea. Or what they mean is sending more billions of dollars in Canadian weaponry to Ukraine so that we can fight to the last Ukrainian. That's what security means for the people running show.
I guess, Aaron, the fires on Maui in Hawaii, they didn't rate security, so they let it burn, okay? Having one of the largest military bases in the world at Pearl Harbor, and they had no access to help those people, okay? It just shows priorities. Aaron, it seems to me what we've discussed in this program here is that elite-driven ideas and agendas, and everything else is left to wither away. Aaron.
Yeah, I mean, that's what an empire exists for. It exists to enrich and aggrandize the oligarchy of the imperialist nation. And the U.S. itself has seen its own development as a democratic society, you know, sidelined by these people. I think in the 1960s, there were elements and strong currents in U.S. society that wanted peace and the solving of human problems. And the leaders who were, leading these popular movements and this popular will, really the prevailable will of the American people, the Kennedy brothers and MLK and Malcolm X, even as he sort of evolved in his political thinking, they killed all these people. So the U.S. is sort of like Iran with 1953 or all the countries in Latin America where the U.S. has intervened. We've had our own development in history altered drastically by these elites, this oligarchy of corporate wealth that's set on dominating the world. And these references to ecological problems and other problems of inequality, I mean, it would really be something if a nation could come along, a powerful nation, and lead the other nations of the world to say, we're going to focus on trying to somehow work together and solve some human problems and respect each other's sovereignty in the meantime. And we want international politics not just to be a game of, of empire.
It's very interesting. I'll go to Matthew now. That's what the global South is talking about collectively, is dealing with these problems. But the West is always spoiling for a fight to maintain hegemony. Matthew.
Well, they always, and I've talked about this for a very long time. It's interesting to me that they're spoiling for a fight to maintain hegemony while, of course, always trying to tell people that that's not what they're doing. that the hegemony is not hegemony at all, but simply American pursuit of global good. I know I keep repeating that phrase, but that's its narrative that it wants others to buy into. I don't think it's been very successful, especially over the last 30 years since the end of the Cold War, but that's been really the ultimate problem. And the elite-driven thing to me matters not just in a historical perspective, but in a contemporary one. American media, mainstream media for sure, has definitely not invested, quote-unquote, educating the masses, the term. That's not where the priority is.
No, what they are the stenographers for power. That's all they are. Okay. All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Washington, Philadelphia, and in Montreal. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.